Hello, my name is Dario Balca, and I'm the student coordinator for the Allard School of Law History Project. It's May 25th, 2020, and I'm joined today by Tamara Levy as part of our oral history project. She's a graduate of Osgoode Hall, a Queen's Counsel appointee, as well as the co-founder and current director of the Innocence Project at UBC. Tamara, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you for having me.
So your career has focused a lot on wrongful convictions and the miscarriage of justice. Can you tell me a bit about why you became interested in this particular area of the law?
Yeah, well, it's been a bit of a long and meandering road, but I think it probably started when I was reflecting on your questions when I myself was a student at Osgoode and I participated in a legal clinic at Osgoode Hall called the Parkdale Legal Clinic. At that point, it was my third term of law school, and I hadn't really found my passion. And that term, part of our work at the legal clinic, I was in the landlord-tenant division, but part of our work involved doing a community project, and I worked with some young people that were mostly of Latin American descent in downtown Toronto. And I worked with them in a community center, got to know them. And over the course of working with them, I learned a lot about their problems with the police and racial profiling and some of the struggles they had at home that had led them to, misbehave in various ways, some of them criminal, falling through the cracks of the school system. And so my interest in sort of fairness and the justice system and criminal law all started, I think, with that experience. And that was the first time that I really considered criminal law as something I would ever be interested in practicing. It was certainly far from what I thought I would be practicing when I went into law school. And that experience led me to seek out articles in criminal policy with the Attorney General in Ontario. And then after that, when I decided to move back to BC, which was my home province, to seek out criminal defense articles. And so I ended up with what was then Peck and Tamman with Richard Peck and now Justice Michael Tamman as my principal. And I had a wonderful articling experience there, which really confirmed for me that criminal law and a commitment to law reform and justice was what I wanted to devote my legal career to. But it wasn't until a couple of years later, after I had done a little bit of defense work and worked for the Crown for a number of years, that I started teaching at UBC. And through teaching an upper year evidence class, we really were focusing on areas of evidence that were the problematic areas of evidence. We were looking at identification evidence and confessions and all of the areas where things can go wrong. I mean, things can go wrong now, we've learned in so many different areas, but they were all sort of difficult areas of evidence. And we eventually realized that really it was all about preventing wrongful convictions. And that's how we renamed the course. And in teaching it, I learned about innocence projects. And in learning about innocence projects and wrongful convictions and the movement that had started in the United States, we started thinking, hey, maybe we could do something here at UBC that would benefit the students and help those in British Columbia that claim to have been wrongly convicted.
Was there anything about the Allard School of Law that you felt made it a particularly good place to start this kind of a project?
I lived in Vancouver, so it made sense that I would want to work here. But as between a law school or a journalism school or a law firm, which are all various places where Innocence Projects have lived in various states in the United States and worldwide, I thought a law school made the most sense because it had the connections to the legal community, which would be necessary to run these cases. It had the support from law students who could learn a lot and benefit from working on these cases, whether or not they are going to Crown or defense. And it was a respected institution, and there was definitely some benefit to aligning work like this with a larger institution that already had a great deal of support and respect in the community.
The work that students do as part of this project is very hands-on, it's very involved, and they're often dealing with some some pretty heavy stuff in terms of what kind of work they're doing. Can you tell me a bit about some of your more memorable moments there, or some of the highlights during your years as director of the Innocence Project at UBC?
Yeah, we've had lots of memorable moments, and you know, every day brings a new interesting situation. But I definitely think that moments that I remember most clearly are getting our first, what we thought then was a clear DNA exclusion about 8 years ago on a case that's still in litigation in front of the Court of Appeal. You know, that was an exciting moment for sure. Winning in that same case, the extension of time application for a client who'd been maintaining innocence after a guilty plea for 34 years. The lawyers on that file, you know, worked so hard in putting that together, and was great and historic for sure when they won that, in addition to getting a ruling that permitted further DNA testing, which we had been seeking. Getting good news from the minister's office on a couple of our cases so far. I remember both of those moments, you know, where I was when I was told that, you know, we'd been approved to move on to the next stage. And then some sadder moments, you know, where we've had two clients die while they're in prison before we've been able to really move their cases along. And those were definitely hard.
Our law school seems to really emphasize and pride itself on offering students a variety of experiences. What do you think this particular experience and those moments that you just described in particular, what effect do those have for students? What do they gain from going through something like that?
Well, I think that the students with the program, they really get a close look at where the justice system can go wrong. And they get to put a face to those cases and the issues that they learn about. You know, some of our cases, at least a couple of them, are cases that they learn about in evidence class that have gone to the Supreme Court of Canada. And now they get to work with the actual person, because that person, although their case made good law, we believe is innocent. That's very interesting for them to go from complete theory, a theoretical and legal analysis, to actually meeting and speaking to the person that was involved with that case. It really is meaningful for the students. A lot of them have reported back at the end of their time with the project that working with the project was the most meaningful experience they had in law school. And they really get an opportunity to work, you know, apart from sort of on cases that have the potential to really impact somebody's life in such a significant way, in a real law office environment where they have to manage files, docket their time, have team meetings with lawyers, with experts, draft correspondence and legal memos, and take the initiative to really investigate the cases and look at all of the issues, leaving no stone unturned, in a way that is really a luxury for lawyers in practice when they have so many other cases going on and such limited funding. So it's a really unique opportunity, even within the criminal law realm, for students to work on these cases. You know, in sort of real criminal law practice, lawyers can, you know, maybe work on one or two innocence files, you know, over the course of their career. And over the year, the students, while they only get to work on one or two files in detail, they get to hear about and be involved with, through our small group meetings, close to 20 cases. So it's a wonderful, I think, learning opportunity for the students, and one in which they gain really important skills that they can take with them, whether they're going into criminal law or other areas of the law. And most of our students don't actually go into criminal law, but they still seem to really value the experience and often come back and want to volunteer in various ways.
These Innocence Projects exist across North America, from what I understand, and they're doing similar kinds of work. But can you think of anything that makes the UBC Innocence Project stand out in terms of what it does or what it's accomplished over the years?
Yeah, well, the Innocence Network is actually worldwide now, with think about 70 organizations internationally. So there are Innocence Projects in Taiwan and Italy and the Netherlands and South America and Australia. So it's really a worldwide network, and it's so interesting to hear what's going on in other countries that have completely different legal systems and how they work for people maintaining their innocence. In terms of UBC, you know, the situation in Canada is quite different than the United States, which is really the largest innocence movement worldwide and where the innocence projects began in New York City. In Canada, we have a different legal system, a different route to innocence, different prison population. We don't have the death penalty. We don't have elected judges and prosecutors. You know, we're working in a very, very different context. And it's important for students to learn about how we're different from what they may see in the Innocence Files and hear on podcasts like Serial and some of the other more popular culture TV shows and radio shows that have brought attention to wrongful convictions. So working with the project, you know, gives us the opportunity at UBC to raise public awareness about the unique challenges in Canada. We're the only Innocence Project west of Ontario and one of only three in Canada that's affiliated with a law school. So I think they, you know, have a very unique opportunity at UBC that you won't get at law schools across the country.
You started to kind of touch on this in your previous answer a little bit, but what would you say are some of the biggest challenges associated with running something like this at Allard?
Well, space is always a challenge, and it's going to be an even bigger challenge now with the current world pandemic that we are all in. We're putting in sort of more distancing measures in the office, but we have a smallish office and students are often accessing the computers, but we're definitely moving to a more remote work environment. So that might make things easier. Accessing information is a very difficult part of this work. You know, we are sometimes looking at files that go back 30 years, 40 years even. We have one case from 1978 and one from 1976. So finding information on those cases, you know, collecting it from defense counsel, going back to the Crown, going to RCMP archives, where maybe the Vancouver archives, just pulling together what we need to even start a review of a file can be a multi-year endeavor. So that's definitely a challenge. Relying on pro bono lawyers that are very busy with their own practices. That's why, you know, we give them the students and why we think that pairing is so important, because the students can do most of the work that is required, but receive direction from experienced lawyers that can help them think about the file and how they need to approach various issues. That can be a challenge, as well as balancing the real casework and student learning, you know, making sure that the students are learning along the way, which for the most part just happens through the work. But thinking about everybody's file has very different needs. So students are going to take away some different skills depending on which file they're working on. But we try to address that by giving students some choice at the beginning of the year, which is happening right now, where they get to hear about all the cases we have on the docket and have some input into which case they would like to work on based on either the issues that are involved with that case or the type of work that's going to be involved. So some cases are going to be very heavy on the investigative side and tracking down witnesses and speaking to people, and some are going to be at a stage where it's all writing and they're going to be writing and editing and doing the footnotes and are at that stage. So it depends on what a student wants to do. So yeah, so balancing the needs of the case and the needs of the student can sometimes be challenging, but we try to make it work.
By the way, for those listening to this interview, however many years in the future, at the time of this interview, we are in the midst of a global pandemic that has required most of us to stay home and work from home in order to avoid physical proximity to others and transmission of the COVID-19 virus. Can you tell me, in terms of the Innocence Project, how you're moving ahead, given that these distancing measures will be in place for, it seems like, the foreseeable future.
It's so far not been so bad for us because we had the wonderful opportunity from a lawyer who donated some money to scan most of the files that we have. So we have most of our files digitally, but not all of them. And we have access to that remotely. So Bernie, who I'm sure you're familiar with at the law school, has been so helpful in getting us all remote access so that we can continue to do our work pretty seamlessly. And we did all of our student interviews by Zoom and selected new students that way. And then we had our first transfer meeting by Zoom and we had our final classes by Zoom. And it all worked really well with the guest speaker appearing from her house. She was actually quarantined at the time because she had just come back from the States and was able to share her presentation, and everybody was able to listen and get out of it, I think, as much as they would have in person. So where I think in the office, sort of because we have 15 students, I think we'll be allowed back in come September, but we will have to meet in a larger classroom so that we can distance. And I think that in the office, we're just going to have to put in definite cleaning protocols and only have two people in the office at once, which in the past, we've squeezed eight people in there. There's people sitting on windowsills and on desks and on the floor, and that's clearly not going to happen going forward, and maybe make more use of our office space upstairs. So, it'll take a little bit more planning. People signing up and just sticking to their schedules a bit more, rather than just dropping in whenever they want. But I think we'll be able to move forward and maybe meet, virtually where we can rather than in person. But so much of the student experience comes from being in the office with the director or in the office downtown with the supervising lawyers and chatting about files, about legal work in general, about their careers, about articles. So I hope we don't lose that in having to restrict the number of people. We'll have to find ways to try to make that happen, maybe in different ways.
Also, for the sake of future clarity, Zoom is a handy video conferencing program that has absolutely taken the world by storm since this whole thing started. Can you tell me more generally what your experience at the law school has been like since you helped co-found the Innocence Project in 2007? And even when you were teaching, you said you were teaching a bit before that.
Yeah, so I started teaching in 2004. I started teaching what's now the Preventing Wrongful Convictions and Miscarriages of Justice class with Mary Ainsley, who is a prosecutor. And she's now on the other side of many of our files at the CASP office, the Criminal Appeals and Special Prosecutions. So we started teaching that class together in 2004. And at the time that we started the project in 2007, and I should say that when we started the project, it wasn't just me. It was, I thought about it definitely, but then a group of students also had been thinking about it and had come across Innocence Projects and had approached Professor Nikos Harris. And Nikos and I actually, we articled at the same law firm and were friends from that time. So between Professor Harris and me and the students, and then we brought in Jeff Campbell, who's now Judge Campbell. He was part of this initial group as well, and we met for about 6 months to start the project. And when Nikos brought it through the Senate approval process and all of the internal approvals we needed to get to have it approved as a new clinic. And at that time, when we opened our doors in 2007, the clinic was in a portable, which was, I guess, right behind the North Parkade, where there's now a huge residence, but that used to be two portables. And the clinic was in a tiny little room where LSLAP was in the same portable. And we worked next to Brian Higgins, who was just a wonderful character who ran LSLAP for years. And we had a lot of fun in that tiny and stinky portable, but that's where we started. And the law school hadn't contemplated our clinic, of course, and there was no space for us. And then the new building was built and we moved into the office that we're currently in. So definitely the space has changed over the years and the conditions we have worked in. And the other thing that I've really seen change, although I'm not very involved in the faculty outside of the clinical faculty, but definitely have felt it through the energy of the students. And in the last couple of years, Dean Dovern has made such a concerted effort to bring in new professors who I think really add diversity and a refreshing approach to the law through their research and teaching. There's just been so many new faces and faculty that I've seen over the last few years. That's nice to see.
Switching gears a little bit, I'd also like to talk about a couple of things that you've done that aren't necessarily related to Allard. In 2015, you co-founded the Criminal Defense Advocacy Society. Can you tell me a bit more about what that is?
Yeah, so the Criminal Defense Advocacy Society, which we refer to as CDAS, came from my involvement and my interest in it, came from the project. And really, we had been approached on several occasions to intervene in cases where lawyers thought perhaps wrongful convictions would be an issue that would arise, or that we could intervene and talk about how the issue that they wanted to raise could impact wrongful convictions. And as a legal clinic in a law school that wasn't an independent entity, but was just a course essentially in a law program, I didn't think we really had the standing to be able to do that, and wanted to see an organization that would be able to intervene in some of these important cases. The second reason that I wanted to see an independent organization for criminal lawyers was an appreciation that there was no organization in BC that represented only defense lawyers and their clients. We had the Trial Lawyers Association of BC for all trial lawyers, including civil, and we had the criminal section of the Canadian Bar Association, which was for both Crown Counsel and defense counsel, but nothing that was just for defense lawyers and their clients. And I thought that there really was a need for an organization that could address law reform issues and advocacy through interventions and other, you know, maybe policy related issues or challenges that were specific to criminal law and defense work in particular. And I had a colleague who had apparently also been thinking about the idea. And so we started to call other defense lawyers, and we slowly built a small group of really excellent and committed counsel to start the organization. And we incorporated, after, you know, many meetings about what this sort of organization would look like, we incorporated in February of 2015, the day before my birthday. And so I remember that date, and it was very, very exciting at the time, but we really didn't know what was going to happen or what the organization would become. And we got a lot of support from senior counsel, from judges, from junior counsel, and we're now close to 300 members. We've intervened at the Supreme Court of Canada 4 times, at the BC Supreme Court once. We have participating in the Cullen Commission. And we quickly realized that CDAS really had a role to play also in the mentorship of articling students. So, you know, I had such close contact with my students and my colleague, Mark Gervin, who was also involved in co-founding CDAS, was or is the legal director of the Indigenous Community Legal Clinic. And so we both have a lot of contact with students interested in criminal law, and we heard from many of them and articling students and young lawyers that there were real issues with mentorship and learning as they were articling and getting guidance from more senior members of the bar. So we wanted the organization to really focus on that as well, and to facilitate meetings and social events for younger members of the criminal defense bar, particularly young female counsel. And so over the years, we've organized many free seminars and now webinars, which have been incredibly popular, on various criminal law issues aimed at defense lawyers from a 0 to 5 year call. And the bar and the judiciary have been so helpful and supportive in participating in that effort, have been so generous with their time in providing that free education, because many of the seminars and conferences, you know, can be very expensive for not just young lawyers, but lawyers in criminal law who don't make a whole lot of money. So the free seminars have been really popular and helpful, I think. And it also brings people together. So it served two purposes in educating and helping the criminal bar build those relationships within it. We also produced a report on the situation of criminal law articles in BC and submitted it to the Law Society, and did another report on the situation of parole and innocence claims in BC, which a former student of the project actually began as a smaller report funded through the UBC Innocence Project. We had funding from the Notary Foundation, and it was certainly something that we had seen in our cases where people were claiming their innocence, they were having very difficult time getting parole. And so she started that report, and we then moved it over to CDAS and got funding through the Law Foundation to fund a larger study into that issue and produced a report for that. So CDAS has done, I think, some great work over the last 5 years, and we're really excited to see what we can do going forward.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I hadn't quite realized the extent to which it intersected with the project and the student experience more generally, and the experiences of the young lawyers. You mentioned in that answer that this was in some ways helpful for young women in law. Can you elaborate a bit on what challenges they might face?
You know, I think it comes as no surprise that in the past, criminal defense work in particular has been an area of the legal profession that certainly attracts more men than women. And you see on the Crown side, generally, traditionally, more women. And I think that, you know, there's lots of reasons for that, but that many talented and interested women want to practice criminal defense. And when ICR students show an interest, you know, really try to support them and connect them with the bar, because it can be at times a bit of a, and I think this is really changing, but certainly looking back 10, 20 years, a real boys club. And, you know, the young male defense counsel would be invited out for drinks and get referred the cases, you know, the smaller cases. And sometimes the women would, even if they were invited, just not feel fully comfortable in that environment. And I think that's really changing. You know, I think that it's changing because we have different men with different experiences entering the profession as well, that, you know, see women as their equals and are absolutely have no problem with that co-ed environment. You know, that allows for women to feel more comfortable. And so what CDAS has done as well is tried to connect those young women entering the profession with senior women. And there, it's difficult because there are not many senior women in criminal defense. So connecting those two groups and then helping young women form, you know, their own connections. And they've actually done a lot of that on their own in creating sort of smaller groups of 15 or 20 women, or a WhatsApp group or whatever, where it's just women and they feel more comfortable asking sort of questions they might not feel comfortable asking in a setting that involved some of their male counterparts. So, you know, I think that there are lots of ways that CDAS can support women going forward in criminal law. And we're also really trying to work with the Law Society on creating or improving their maternity benefits or parental leave benefit to support people that want to have families that are in criminal defense work, because it's also an area that is not very conducive at the moment to, as a sole practitioner, to having a young family.
In keeping with this idea of education and connection and mentorship, you've also chaired and spoken at the Trial Lawyers Association of BC, and I'm wondering, what kind of messages do you try to send fellow lawyers and law students when you get opportunities like that?
Well, it depends on the subject, you know, like to target the audience. If I'm talking about wrongful convictions, I really just try to raise awareness about the issues and about the causes, about the differences between Canada and the United States or elsewhere in the world, and try to really hammer home how easy it is for things to go wrong in the criminal justice system despite everyone's best efforts. There are just too many people involved to always end up with the right verdict. And I always like to quote former Justice, Chief Justice McLaughlin. You know, she, now I won't get the quote exactly right, but in speaking to a bunch of judges at a judicial education seminar, she said something like, you know, the criminal justice system is a human endeavor, and like every human endeavor, it will have its share of mistakes. And our job is to, you know, look for ways to remedy those mistakes. And so that's really what I like to keep in mind with the work that we do, is to try to find where mistakes possibly could have been made and look for ways to remedy those mistakes. You know, if I'm talking about criminal law generally, I like to tell people to, or students or prospective students, just to always be curious and ask questions about the witnesses and the evidence in a case, because there's always more to the story.
What's on the horizon for you? Are there any, is there anything in the future of the Innocence Project, or in your future more generally, that you'd like to share?
Well, I really love this work, and it's been such a wonderful way to balance my interest in criminal law and have a solid and robust family life. I love working with the students and all of the lawyers that I get to work with. I would really love to see more of our cases reach the minister's office and see them through to the end, whatever that end might be, just to follow them through and finish them up. But more cases are always coming in. I mean, they don't come in at the rate that people sometimes think. Generally, once people go to prison, they just want to do their time and get out, and they admit their guilt and they move forward. But on the rare occasions, people are innocent and maintain their innocence and fight for the truth to come to light, and continue fighting even sometimes when they get out of prison. So I'll be satisfied as long as I feel that we have done everything we can to get to the truth in those cases, and then we'll see. I don't know what's next after that.
You kind of addressed some of this a few moments ago, but thinking about going to law school and starting law school can be a bit of a scary experience, and I think people really value advice and mentorship. So I'm wondering what you'd say to anyone who finds themselves in that situation.
Yeah, I have often have either, you know, sons or daughters of friends or colleagues talk to me about, should I go to law school, and, you know, is it the right decision for me? And I always say that, you know, law school is just like a ticket to opening doors to so many different areas, you know, and going to law school is really just about training your mind and educating you on a way to think and analyze and question the world around you. And you can then take those skills in writing and questioning and analyzing so many different directions, whether you want to go into law, and within law there are so many different options of areas of practice that can suit every personality and every talent, or you can go into reform, you know, law reform and policy or politics, or you can go into business. You know, there's just so many different ways you can take a law degree that I think it's an excellent education for anyone, really, and just learning about the world around you and how things operate allows you to understand so many different aspects of society.
Tamara Levy, this has been truly fascinating. Thank you for joining me and being part of the History Project.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.